Greetings, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisa Kores, the Chair of the Club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your co-chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Professor Leonard Susskind. Dr. Leonard Susskind is a Felix Bloch Professor of Theoretical Physics at Stanford University and Director of the Stanford Institute for Theoretical Physics. His research interests include string theory, quantum field theory, quantum statistical mechanics, and quantum cosmology. Professor Susskind is a member of the National Academy of Sciences and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, an associate member of the faculty of Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, and a distinguished professor of the Korea Institute for Advanced Study. Professor Susskind is widely regarded as one of the fathers of string theory, introducing the idea that particles could in fact be states of excitation of a relativistic string. Professor Susskind was the first to introduce the idea of the string theory landscape in 2003. He has won both the Prigel Award from the New York Academy of Sciences and the J.J. Sakurai Prize in Theoretical Particle Physics. Professor Susskind's presentation today is based on his new book, The Theoretical Minimum: What You Need to Know to Start Doing Physics. Please join me in welcoming Professor Leonard Susskind.
Thank you. I was surprised and delighted to be invited back here for a second time after what may have been a debacle the first time. I am a bit of a loose cannon, and I'm very, very bad at following instructions. I'm therefore absolutely flabbergasted to be invited back the third time. Before I start, I want to introduce my offspring, string theory. String theory, Susskind, will you raise your hand? I am her father. Okay. What I like about these events best is actually answering questions. It's what winds me up. It's what motivates me to think about how to address a public, is to get questions from them. Unfortunately, the question period only comes after what I'm told has to be 35 minutes of me pontificating here and going on and on. So I absolutely have no idea of whether I'm going to talk for 35 minutes, 25 minutes, 10 minutes, or 2.5 hours. But I will start, and hopefully we'll get to the question session, which is what I love best about all events of this type. Now, what am I going to talk about? I am not tonight going to talk about physics. Not physics, not cosmology, not string theory, none of those things. I'm going to talk about how I came to write a book called The Theoretical Minimum. I'm going to tell you what the book is about, why I wrote it, how I came to write it. And when I started to think about, you know, what it was that led me to write such a book, it drove me way, way back to my early childhood, seriously. I wondered, why did I go to the effort of writing what is fundamentally a textbook on classical mechanics, an extremely dry subject, for a general, not for a general audience, but for an educated scientific audience? And when I thought about it, I realized that it really did go way, way back to in my own personal history. And so I thought I would tell you a little bit about how I got to this point of writing such a book. My grandparents, it does go way back to that, my grandparents came to the United States from Tsarist Russia around 1900. They were poor, they were working class people, but on my father's side, they were working class intellectuals. They were political, they were leftists, they were anarchists, they were Marxists. They were Jews, but their only real religion was social justice and the Union. They probably had to leave Russia for their health, if you know what I mean. My paternal grandfather was said to be a tall, handsome, aristocratic-looking man who spoke excellent English. He was a house painter whom in Russia had painted palaces and cathedrals, or at least that's the family myth. When he came to the United States, he painted tenement buildings in the South Bronx. He was a Union man, but he was also a compulsive gambler. Being a compulsive gambler, he left the family absolutely destitute. So destitute that my father had to leave school at the age of 12. What did he do? He became a plumber. He became a plumber's helper at the age of 12. Having to leave school for him was a trauma, a real trauma. It was a tragedy. He loved school, or at least in his own memory, he loved school. In my own memory, I loved school also, but actually I hated it. But it was a trauma, and it stayed with him for the rest of his life. By the let me show you a picture. I have a picture here of just for fun. I went and got some pictures. That is my father, the big one. The other one is my aunt Louise. They're both dead by now. That picture was taken, I think, in 1910. 1910 or 1909, I'm not sure which. And that gives you some idea of where I came from. This picture was taken in 1940. This picture was taken in 1940. Again, that's my father. And 1940 happens to be the year I was born. When I look really, really carefully, and you can try to look really carefully way up there at the date on the calendar, it says June 1940. As a matter of fact, I was born on June 1940, on the 16th of June. I have a suspicion that that picture was taken on the day I was born. That's Benny Susskind. Benny Susskind, plumber. By that time, he was already a distinguished plumber, a professor of plumbing. He was considered a master of his trade, and he was the foreman in Jack Sherman's plumbing shop in the Bronx. By 1941, the war had broken out. Well, not quite, but the war was about to break out. And so our little family, my father, my mother, and I went off to war. Not in Japan, not in Germany, but in Louisiana. My father was a plumber, and the country needed plumbers. It needed plumbers to build munitions factories, aircraft factories, tank factories. That's what he did, and it was all in the very, very deep South. My father's experience in the deep South left him scarred again, psychologically scarred again. He was witness to unprovoked murder. He was witness to beatings, racial events. He came back with the strongest possible feelings about social justice, about racism, all those sorts of things. And my father was my hero. I think you can guess that from what I'm saying. He's always been my hero. In any case, I grew up among a bunch of plumbers. My father's friends. Oh, incidentally, I have another picture here. Yeah, I do have another picture here. This was a gang of plumbers who built an aircraft, not an aircraft carrier, an aircraft factory in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, I think. Now, I am not absolutely sure who is who in this picture. I am quite certain that the upper left-hand circle is my father. The one just slightly to the right of him is named Moish Indersky. Moish, everybody know the name Moish? Yeah, it's Yiddish for Moshe. In other words, Moses. And down on the right, that's Jimmy Green. Jimmy Green was also my father's friend, and the rest of them are Local 2. Local 2 is the union that my father was a member of, and they all went down simultaneously to the south to build munitions plants. That's the background that I came from. Well, we'll come to that in a minute. Anyway, I grew up among this gang of plumbers, and they all shared the same feature, that they had no formal education. Basically, all of them had to leave school at a very, very young age. You might think that that would mean that they were uneducated. They were not uneducated, or at least they were self-educated. What they thought about on our kitchen table when they would eat, when they would drink, when they would do whatever we would do at the kitchen table when I was a young kid was talk. And they talked, and they talked, and they talked. What did they talk about? They talked about politics, they talked about history, and they talked about science. At least science as well as they knew it, which was not very well, but they did talk about science. But there was a problem. The big problem is that they had no way of telling what was real science, the real thing, from fringe, lunatic silliness. Sometimes fringe, lunatic silliness comes couched in terms that sound so academic that you really can't tell what's what. You can't really tell what's true and what's just silliness. When I was about 10 years old, my father's best friend, Moish Andersky, brought me a book. It was a book that had just come out, and he was very, very excited about it. It explained everything about the world, everything about prehistory and history. It explained the Bible. It explained the Iliad. It explained everything that had happened in scientific terms. It explained the parting of the waters. It explained the flood. It explained the stopping of the sun in the sky. All of these things, and it was by a gentleman by the name of Emanuel Velikovsky. Emanuel Velikovsky was a nutcase. But he sounded awfully good. He claimed that 1,500 years before Christ, the planet Venus had been ejected out of Jupiter, almost collided with the Earth, created all sorts of havoc on the Earth, then went back out, almost collided with Mars, shot Mars into another orbit, the other orbit almost collided again with the Earth. And I don't remember which biblical event had to do with which, but this sounded amazing. It sounded fantastic. And the whole wonderful, wonderful. I was a young kid, and the world was being explained to me by science. There were all sorts of scientific terms in it. Electromagnetic radiation, the magnetosphere, all sorts of things that really captured my imagination. In retrospect, it sounds funny. It sounds very funny, in fact. What were we thinking? But in fact, the real truth is that there was no way that I, my father, or Moish could possibly know that this was junk. There was no way, there was nobody to tell us, there was nobody around who could instruct us in what was sensible, what was not sensible. And so we believed it. We had no idea that it wasn't true. A few years later, by the time I was about 18, I was also a plumber. And I probably would have, fortunately, I did not have to leave school. But I was already a plumber, and fortunately, my father had an idea. This actually was a good idea. It was not a crackpot idea. He was very, very familiar with the buildings in the South Bronx. And he knew that the furnaces which heated the buildings, this is a furnace from about probably around 1890. It was a furnace that was in the South Bronx that heated a tenement building. And these furnaces were rotting. They were falling apart. My father realized that they had to be changed. He knew that it was necessary to convert to some more modern kind of system. So he decided, this is what we're going to do. We're going to get into this business, into the heating business. But he didn't know very much about heat. He didn't know about thermodynamics. In fact, he didn't know what a BTU was, a BTU, a British thermal unit. And all of the literature in that time and the handbooks and so forth was about BTUs. He didn't know what it was, and so he said, Sonny, I was called Sonny at the time. Sonny, you have to go to college. You have to go to college, learn about engineering, figure out what this BTU thing is. Okay. You might ask, how on earth could I possibly afford college? Well, I couldn't afford college, but fortunately, those were better times for poor people. There was a social network by then, and not only was there a social network, but there was a free college, CCNY in New York, City College in New York, and it didn't cost a nickel, cost absolutely nothing. The result was that I went to CCNY, in fact, they even paid me. They paid me, I think, $1,000 a year to be able to buy books. So that was a time when I think we should aspire to reproducing, namely a time when young people who were not rich could go to college and get an education. This idea seems to be in jeopardy at the present time. I hope that will pass, and I hope the time will come when young immigrant children can again go to college without it costing them an arm and a leg. But in any case, I did go to college. And, of course, the first thing I learned was that I hated engineering. The next thing I learned was that I loved physics. One way or another, I took a physics course and got hooked, seriously hooked. So I had to tell my father I was not going to be an engineer. I wasn't going to be a plumber. I was going to be a physicist. I remember telling my father I'm going to be a physicist. I was sort of really worried about it. And he looked at me and he said, "Why do you want to work in a drugstore?" He didn't know physicist from pharmacist. I said, "No, Dad." Actually, I didn't call him Dad. He was Ben to me. "No, Ben, that's not what I want to be. I don't want to be a druggist. Einstein was a physicist." Well, the word Einstein just ticked off in his head. And he asked me, "Are you any good at that?" I said, "Yes, I'm really good at it." And from that moment on, as far as he was concerned, there was no question of what I would do with the rest of my life. I was going to be a physicist. In fact, he had always imagined that he and I would work together. Well, if we weren't going to work together on heating systems, we would work together on physics. It was simple. All he had to do was get a few books on physics and read them and find out what physics was about, and we would work on it together. Not so easy. Fifth grade education, he had to learn. He knew arithmetic. He was a master at arithmetic. In fact, he knew a lot of things. He knew how to calculate the hypotenuse of a right triangle. Every plumber had to be able to calculate the hypotenuse of a right triangle. He knew things that I wouldn't have known, except that he told me that if you hook a iron pipe to a brass pipe, the place where they join, electrolysis happens and rot happens. It corrodes. He knew all sorts of things, but he didn't have the background to be able to easily learn theoretical physics. He died in 1978, still trying to learn calculus and still trying to learn from books which were too fat, too thick, too complicated, and too damn boring. So that was the history of my father's attempt to become a physicist. It did not succeed. These experiences with my father and with Moshe Nedersky were my first exposure to this problem of how do you educate people to be able to know what's serious science, what's fake science, what's fringe, what's lunatic, and to be able to tell it from the real thing. Unfortunately, a large fraction of the media, and by the media I now mean the pop science, the popular science journals and so forth, are not very helpful. If you read Discover magazine, you will get the feeling that a scientific revolution occurs every other day. It doesn't. Even Scientific American and New Scientist, if you read them, you will discover that one of their priorities, maybe not their highest priority, But one of their priorities is to keep their readership high. How do you keep your readership high? By writing things that sound awfully sensational. So the media, and by that I mean the relatively high-quality media, is not terribly helpful at it. So that is a problem. It's a big problem. About 12 years ago, I decided to try to fill the gap a little bit, to teach a course on modern physics in Stanford's Continuing Studies program. Continuing Studies, incidentally, is a program for people from the community, not academic people, not students at Stanford University, but just people, and it's cheap. It's not very expensive. You pay a couple of $100s and you get a pretty good course. I decided to teach a course for those people, and of course my idea was to teach a layperson's course, to teach it in lay terms, to teach it in a way that the average person could understand, at least insofar as I could. What tended to happen, the teaching was okay, the students learned, but one of the things that they would come to me with repeatedly was questions about what they read in the media. They would come to me the questions about dark energy. Is it true that you can tap dark energy, that you can mine it, and that you can use it for running the world? They came to me with questions about black holes. Is it true that you can fly from one universe to another universe by going through a black hole? Does quantum entanglement really allow you to communicate with very, very distant civilizations? All of this, of course, was, I don't know what the word is, crapola. So I would try to answer them. I did answer them. They were pretty happy with the answers. But I also decided what I wanted to do was to try to design a way, an algorithm, if you like, that they themselves could figure out whether something was high quality, whether it was mainstream, or whether it was fringe. I started to think about that. My first idea was, if it comes from a Nobel Prize winner, it must be pretty good. Yeah, sometimes yes, sometimes no. 2 weeks later, one of the students came in with an article about quantum ESP, extrasensory perception. I looked at it, and indeed, it did come from a Nobel Prize winner. I won't tell you who it was. It doesn't matter. It's somebody who's sort of known to be a little bit unusual. And I realized that the idea of saying if it comes from somebody eminent, it's almost certainly right, is almost certainly wrong, or at least some of the times wrong. That didn't work. It was just a failure. We tried it in several different ways. Next idea, if it comes from an eminent institution, if it comes from the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, it's got to be good. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks later, maybe it was 3 weeks later, maybe even it was a month later, I don't remember, one of my students, I think his name is Sanjay, came and he had an article about tapping the dark energy, using it to run things, dark energy in the universe. I knew that this is silly. This is complete garbage. But he said, look, this comes from the Institute for Advanced Study. Who's the author? He said, the author's name is H. Putoff. Putoff. P-U-T-O-F-F. Or maybe it's P-U-T-H-O-F-F. Hal Putoff. I looked at him, I said, wait a minute, look. I know the director of the Institute of Advanced Studies. He's a friend of mine. His name is not Hal Putoff. Let me look at that. I look a little closer and a little closer, and finally I see, yes, it says from the article, not the article in the press, but the actual physics article. The actual physics article says, Hal Putoff, Director, Institute for Advanced Study. I look at it a little more carefully, and way down in the bottom in tiny print, it says, Institute for Advanced Study in Texas. This was a one-man operation, which I rather suspect was funded by some right-wing nut job. I don't know who it was, but it was not the Institute for Advanced Study. But how would my poor student Sanjay know that? Again, failure. No algorithm that I could think of could distinguish consistently between what was genuine, what was flaky, what was fringe. The solution to the problem basically came from my students in my class. They said, stop teaching us physics light. Teach us the real thing. Teach it with equations. Give us the tools. Give us the tools. Some of us don't know a lot of mathematics. If you have to, teach us some mathematics along the way. Teach us the real thing, and we will have the tools to be able to decide for ourselves. My reaction to it was, yeah, fat chance. I will start teaching this way, and by halfway through the quarter, the room will be empty. They said, no, the room will not be empty. It will be even more full. I said, okay, I'll try it. We'll do it the real way. We'll do it with equations. We'll do it with mathematics. They were right. I was wrong. There was absolutely no sense that people were bored or unwilling to put in the work to find out the truth, to find out how to do it right. I think it's not just Stanford area where that's true. As far as I can tell, the world is just absolutely chock full of people who are hungry and curious about the way the universe works. They want to know, and they are fed up with the Discover magazine version of it. They're even fed up with the Scientific American version of it. They want the real thing. But they want the real thing not in the form of big, fat, thick textbooks, which take years to read, and a guide like a physics professor to take them through it. They want something more streamlined. They want something that captures the essence of the subject, that captures the essence of the subject in as small and efficient a way as possible. That's what led me to start to think about writing The Theoretical Minimum. Something else happened along the way. Somebody, and I don't remember who it was, had the bright idea of putting the lectures on the internet. So we started to videotape the lectures. The videotapes, lectures are out there. They're on, is it iTunes, YouTube? I can never figure out the difference between these things, but they're out there. And it's an incredibly popular site. Literally millions of people follow the details of theoretical physics on the blackboard as done by a theoretical physicist, and really follow. I get huge amounts of email. Some of it comes from old codgers, people as old as 95 years old. But a lot of it, I'm glad to say, and I'm extremely pleased to say, comes from young people, high school students, teenagers, wannabe physicists. And when I say they're wannabe physicists, I mean exactly that. They wannabe physicists. That's a source of enormous satisfaction for me that these people are following, reading. But one of the questions that kept coming up was, are you ever going to publish the notes as books? The Theoretical Minimum is the answer to that. This is the book. This is the first volume. This is the first volume, and it's on the subject of classical mechanics. Classical mechanics is the starting point for physics. No physics can be done by anybody who has not learned classical mechanics. So perhaps I should... I think you get the point. That was the origin of my own history of deciding to try to create something new, namely the absolute smallest volume of physics that I could make that captures the essence of it and that allows you to go on to the next step. That's what I meant by the theoretical minimum. Now, the term theoretical minimum, in fact, did not come from me. Where the hell did that come from? Help.
It goes to sleep.
It goes to sleep. So, so does the audience after a while.
Yeah, so that everybody can wake. Okay, here we go. And then...
All right, so the term theoretical minimum did not come from me. It came from a very, very famous physicist, Lev Landau. Lev Landau was the great physicist of the Soviet Union, of Russia, of Russian physics. And I have a picture of Lev here, but that doesn't matter very much. Lev Landau meant something entirely different by the theoretical minimum than I do. What he meant, the theoretical minimum was an examination in Russia. It was the examination which, if you passed it, allowed you to be one of Lev Landau's students. To be one of Lev Landau's students, you had to know almost as much as he knew, and Lev Landau knew everything. Oh, that doesn't look like Lev Landau. That does. There he is. He was a very arrogant man, and his view was, unless you knew almost as much as he did, he would not allow you to be part of his institute. So the theoretical minimum for him meant almost knowing everything. For me, it means exactly the opposite. It means literally knowing the minimum, distilling out of a subject everything which is essential, the essentials which are necessary to move on to the next thing. In this case, the essentials that are necessary to move on, for example, to quantum mechanics. Nothing more, nothing extraneous, just the minimum. So that was what I decided to write. The first volume is out now. Incidentally, I was sort of stunned and absolutely amazed by the fact that it was, for a short period of time, number one on Amazon. It has maintained its position somewhere as 1, 2, 3, or 4 for the last several days. I don't think this says anything about the quality of the book, because the people haven't read the book yet. I think what it says is what I had guessed, that there's a large number of people out there that are just hungry to understand the universe, and hungry to understand it right, and hungry to understand it in the real way, the genuine way. That, I think, is what it says. So it's a tribute not to the book that I wrote, but to the curiosity of people that are out there. In any case, the first volume of the theoretical minimum is about classical physics, classical mechanics, and I'm just going to spend the next couple of minutes just telling you about what classical mechanics is and the very, very first chapter of the book. After that, you can go on from there and read it yourself. Oh, no, there was something else. Sorry. You see, this is why they sometimes take a long time to invite me back. I do make mistakes when I'm lecturing. Okay, the other thing I wanted to say was something about the difference between writing for the general public non-mathematically and writing for the general public mathematically, the real thing versus the half-baked version. I have written lots of half-baked stuff. I wrote several books for the general public. They're not really half-baked. I think they're okay, but they don't do the job right. What they do is they substitute for the real thing analogies and metaphors. Now, analogies and metaphors are very, very useful for thinking about complicated things, but unless you know how to use them, and unless you really know how to think about them, you'll often get the wrong message. You'll pull away from the analogy the wrong thing. I'll give you a couple of examples. You all, I suspect, know the analogy of the universe as the surface of a balloon. That's fine until somebody comes and asks you, where does the air come from to fill up the balloon? Well, they just took the wrong message away from an analogy, which is a good analogy, but they took the wrong message. That happens over and over again. The other example comes from the Higgs phenomenon. When people say the Higgs phenomenon is the thing which gives particles mass, and then they try to give an analogy. The usual analogy is that the Higgs field is sort of like filling the universe with molasses that slows down particles so that they move as if they were very heavy. Well, this is completely wrong. One of the things that molasses does to particles is it stops them. A particle that's moving through molasses just comes to rest. A massive particle moving through space does not come to rest. Completely wrong analogy, and yet that's the typical analogy that's out there for what the Higgs phenomenon is. There's another one I read that the Higgs field is like the snow in your driveway. It prevents your car from moving. These are bad analogies, but they're sort of the best that people can do under the circumstances. What's the alternative? The alternative is to do it right, to do it right with the equations, with the real things. So what I would say to you is, if you're afraid of equations and you really don't want to get involved with equations, my publisher will hate me for this, but don't buy this book. But if you're willing to invest a little bit of effort into following the mathematics, then I think this is a good book. So you will decide that for yourselves. What is classical physics? Classical physics is deterministic physics. Ah, here's another analogy. Excuse me. Here's another analogy. You've all seen this analogy. It's supposed to be an analogy for how gravity works in Einstein's theory. According to Einstein, the presence of a heavy mass, in this case the sun at the center, distorts space. It deforms it. Sort of like the sun sitting on a rubber sheet and deforming it. Because it's deformed, so the analogy goes, it causes other particles, there's another other objects, the Earth orbiting around it, to get pulled toward the sun. When it gets pulled toward the sun, it can either orbit around the sun or fall into the sun. It explains gravity. The curvature of space explains gravity. Well, nonsense. The reason that the ball at the center creates that dimple is because of the gravity of the Earth underneath. The gravity of the Earth underneath is what is causing the dimple to form. It is not that the dimple explains gravity. It's that gravity creates the dimple. Another false analogy. I meant to put this one in, but I forgot about it. Nevertheless, let's come back to the question. What is classical physics? Classical physics is deterministic physics. It's the physics in which you can predict everything if you know enough. This is a famous quote from Laplace. Laplace was a 17th and early 18th century physicist, maybe the greatest of the physicists of that age, a Frenchman. And here is a quote. I like this quote very much, even though it's badly translated from the French. But nevertheless, the quote goes as follows, and it is a real description of what classical physics is. Let me read it to you. We may regard the present state of the universe as the effect of its past and the cause of its future. An intellect, which at a certain moment would know all the forces that set nature in motion and all positions, and I've added velocities, of all items. What is an item? An item means a particle. Of all items of which nature is composed, if this intellect were also vast enough to submit these data to analysis, it would embrace in a single formula the movements of the greatest bodies of the universe and those of the tiniest atom. For such an intellect, nothing would be uncertain, and the future, just like the past, would be present before its eyes. In other words, classical physics, and here he meant Newtonian physics, classical physics is predictive, and it allows you not only to predict the future if you know things well enough, but it also allows you to tell what was in the past. That's classical physics in a nutshell. The first chapter of the theoretical minimum begins with a very, very, very simple example of deterministic physics. It's the deterministic physics of a model based on a coin which has two states, heads and tails. Now, I'm imagining the coin is on the table, and it either shows heads or tails. And the first example of a deterministic law is so simple it's ridiculous. The first example is that nothing happens. If you put the coin down heads, it just stays heads. It stays heads forever and ever. Heads, 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 heads. That's a deterministic law. If it starts tails, it stays tails, 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 tails. That's very, very predictive. Laplace would say this is a wonderful example of a deterministic law of physics. Wherever you happen to be at the present could be anywhere along that line, You can say exactly what was happening in the past, and you can say exactly what was happening in the future. This is a very dull and boring law of physics. Nothing happens. Here's a slightly more interesting law of physics. If the coin is heads at one instant, then 1 second later, it will flip to tails. If it's tails, 1 second later, it will flip to heads. What happens? Well, if you start with heads, it's heads, tails, heads, tails, heads, tails, heads, tails. If you start with tails, it's tails, heads, tails, heads, tails, heads, tails, heads. Wherever you happen to be, you can predict what's in front of you, and you can predict what's in back of you. This, again, is completely deterministic. It's a little more interesting than the previous case, but it satisfies exactly the rules that Laplace enunciated, that if you know the history, if you know the present, you can predict the past or the future. Here's another law of physics. Now, this one, there seems to be something a little wrong with. Question is, can we see what's wrong with it? The rule is, if your head's at a given instant, you then go to tails. If you're tails, you stay tails. Is this deterministic? You bet it's deterministic. If you start with heads, it becomes tails, and then it stays tails, 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 tails. If you start with tails, you just get tails, tails, tails. But there's something funny about it. Something a little bit funny about it. What's funny about it, it doesn't allow you to deduce what was in the past. If you know that you're tails, you don't know whether you came from heads or whether you came from tails. You can't tell. This is deterministic to the future, but it's not deterministic to the past. It is not what physicists would call reversible. Deterministic plus reversible is the basic rule of classical physics. Classical physics is the physics of what can predict the future and what can predict the past. And another way to say it is it's the physics which conserves information. You never lose information. Wherever you are, you can predict the past, you can predict the future. That's what classical physics is all about. From this very simple example, the book goes on to extrapolate to Newton's equations, which are deterministic equations, the principle of least action, the Hamilton equations of motion. All of classical mechanics is based on this very basic, simple principle that deterministic and reversible. So if you wish to know more, there is a book full of it, but you can also ask me questions now. I think I have come to the end of my little expository explanation of how I got here. Now you can ask me questions about anything you want.
Our thanks to Professor Saskin for his comments here today. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to The Theoretical Minimum, What You Need to Know to Start Doing Physics, with Professor Leonard Susskind. Now, we open the floor to a Q&A. We will probably give maybe 10 to 15 minutes of Q&A time. After that, we have a book signing session. Please keep your questions short and to the point. And also, please make sure your questions are, in fact, questions and not statements.
Oh, yes.
Okay, so I'm going to pass around this microphone. If you have any questions, please raise your hand and make sure to speak into the microphone as we are recording.
I'm glad to find out that you're so in the forefront of string theory. String theory postulates at least 11 different dimensions, and some of its successors go way beyond that. My question is there serious scientific study of, well, not only what that might mean, but whether that's even a valid kind of concept? Where is thinking on multiple dimensions and, for that matter, movement between them?
Sounded like a question, but I'm not really sure it was. I think what you're asking me or telling me, properly so, is that string theory has no empirical evidence associated with it. Yeah. That's somewhat in the mind of the beholder. String theory is the only theory that we know. The only theory that we know, that doesn't mean it's the only theory that exists, which contains within its mathematics both quantum mechanics and gravity. That's saying a lot. It does not mean that string theory is the right theory of nature, but the fact that the world is quantum mechanical and that the world contains gravity is a piece of evidence that does not confirm string theory. That would be much, much too strong. But it's a piece of evidence that suggests that it might be along the right track. Now, from all we learn about the theory, we learn more and more that it's not a theory of uniqueness, but it's a theory of enormous diversity. And there's no question that it is going to be exceedingly difficult, if possible at all, to confirm with definiteness that string theory is the right theory. It's going to be very, very hard. But at the moment, it really is the only consistent mathematical framework in which we can ask the kind of questions about cosmology, about gravity, about particles. And so, actually, I would say, we don't know. We don't know. And the answer is that string theorists are trying their very best to design questions which can be answered in the future. But it's tough. It's very hard. So you're perfectly right that there is this big problem. And it's not just string theory. Physics has moved into domains of very, very remote parameters. It's not just string theory. It's cosmology. The universe is too big for us to see all of it. Strings are too small to see them. We move into domains of parameters which are so distant that experiments look to become harder and harder and harder as time goes on. How we are going to deal with that, I don't know. I really don't know how we're going to deal with the fact that an experiment to determine if particles are really made of strings would take an accelerator as big as the galaxy. An experiment to determine if there are other universes out there would require a degree of precision in astronomy which is way, way, way far beyond what is really feasible. And the answer is, I don't know. I don't know how we are going to do this, how we're going to turn a set of ideas into the kind of definitive physics that we think of as textbook physics that will be in the textbooks 100 years from now. So I honestly can't answer your question. I don't know.
Do you feel that you've answered the part of the question having to do with multiple dimensions and perhaps movement amongst those dimensions?
Multiple dimensions are a consequence of string theory. We can't not have them. String theory just doesn't work without the extra dimensions. It's a mathematical fact. It's a deep mathematical fact. And however, I would say something else. Every theory of elementary particles that we know and trust, going back 75 years or more, long before string theory, does make use in one way or another of extra dimensions of space. This goes way back, and there really are no theories of elementary particles which explain its symmetries, which don't in some form or another postulate extra dimensions of space that are too small to see. So it's not just a consequence of string theory. It's something which is rather embedded in physics for a very long time. You can ask me later for more details about it.
Next question.
I'm very curious as to how you deal with the problem of mathematics knowledge as you move into talking about more and more complex physics.
How you deal with mathematical knowledge.
Or lack of it.
Well, you mean educationally?
No, I'm talking about in your class. Your
educationally.
Yeah,
educationally. Most of the people in my class have some limited background. The rules for the class, there's no rules. Anybody can come. And in fact, some people come who don't know any mathematics. They seem to enjoy it. Maybe it's a sort of masochistic pleasure. But the general rule is, if you once knew calculus, that's good enough. Even if your calculus is very rusty, it's like anything else, you develop some muscle memory for something, and when you start trying to do it again, it comes back. So I tell people, if at one point in your life you knew how to do calculus and you were able to use it a little bit, good enough. For those who don't have any mathematics, well, they're at a real disadvantage. But I do tend to teach some mathematics. For example, in this book, there's a primer, I guess it's called, on calculus. Well, if you don't know algebra, you ain't going to get very far. But if you are new calculus and you're rusty at it, there's probably enough in here to get you going again. This gentleman here has been waiting to ask.
The Higgs boson has been in the news sensationally. Why is its confirmation important?
Well, its confirmation is important because it's a mathematical necessity for the rest of the standard model of particle physics to fit together correctly. It is just a mathematical consequence of everything that came before. There's a lecture out there on the internet lectures that I've given about the Higgs boson, and I refer you to it. But the simple answer is the theory would be mathematically inconsistent without it. And given that, we don't like mathematically inconsistent theories, and so we'd be very, very troubled, extremely troubled, if the Higgs boson weren't there. So in that sense, the Higgs boson, the discovery of the Higgs boson, was not really in the purest sense a discovery. Everybody who does physics was almost everybody was absolutely certain that it was there, but we all heaved a huge sigh of relief when it actually turned out to be there. So that's what I can say about it. It is an enormous success of pure theory, in a sense. Pure theory, 50 years ago, whenever it was, realized that the mathematical structure could not be complete without it. At that time, it looked like another one of these very remote questions, which would take an enormous accelerator, and it almost seemed out of reach. It is a huge success of both theoretical and experimental physics, but it was not an unexpected thing. So we're all happy. We had a big party over it.
All right. We'll take another question.
A rather simple one. Do you think really learning physics enables us to understand the universe?
I didn't catch the question. I heard understand the universe.
Yes.
But what was the question?
The question is, you said learning physics.
Yes.
Enables us to understand the universe.
Well, I think that's what we're all trying to do, is to understand the universe, to understand the laws that govern the universe, to understand the reasons why the universe is expanding, to understand the reasons why the universe is the way it is. I'm not exactly sure what the question is, but yes, that is certainly the goal. The goal is to understand the laws of the universe.
I thought always learning physics enables us to understand the relations between phenomena, but we don't get to the core of the phenomena.
Well, I think what you're saying, which I would agree with, is the universe is a phenomenon, of course. It is a phenomenon. And understanding the relationship between the universe as a phenomenon, its expansion, its properties, and other phenomena, such as the existence of an electron, such as the existence of the relationship between these, is part of physics. But I think if what you're asking is whether we ever can expect to completely understand everything, I don't know. I don't know whether we can ever expect to have a final understanding of the universe. But what I do know, and what I am absolutely certain of, is we are nowhere near it.
Okay, we'll take two more questions. This gentleman first.
Hi. I got an impression your book, first book, is just a start. Do you have any plan how many more books you plan to write and on which subjects of physics?
Yeah. Next one is on quantum mechanics. The question was, what comes after this? This book should have been titled. I had an argument with my publisher. I wanted him to write The Theoretical Minimum, Volume 1. Okay? He didn't want to write Volume 1 because he wasn't sure that this one would sell very well. Okay? It hit number 1 on Amazon, so the next one will be Theoretical Minimum, Volume 2. Volume 2 will be quantum mechanics, the basic essence of quantum mechanics, basic rules, the basic elements of it. That will be number 2. There will be special relativity and electricity and magnetism. That will be 3. Right now in the works, the course that I'm teaching now, which is being actually written at the same time, will be cosmology. So, yeah, there will be at least 6 books, assuming I live that long.
Okay, we'll take the last question.
Do you need any more math beyond, say, differential equations to understand the standard model?
I don't think so. I would say having a background in basic calculus and differential equations is what you need, and that's all you need to get started. You don't need a hell of a lot more mathematics than that to get the essence and to get the basic structure of it. To do some of the fancy gymnastics that quantum field theorists do and some of the very, very hard questions, sure you need more than that. But no, I don't think you need more mathematics than basic calculus, differential equations, and maybe linear algebra. I think that's what you need, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Professor Saskin for his comments here today. We also thank our audience here, as well as those listening to this recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 110th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you. Thank you for joining us this evening. Copies of the book, The Theoretical Minimum, are available for purchase, and Professor Saskind is kindly staying around to field any additional questions you may have and sign your copy of the book. We also thank fellow club members who kindly volunteered for this program. They are Rick Karneski, Rene Miguel, and George Hammond, the chair of the club's Humanities Member-Led Forum. Thank you so much.